Okay.
You're recording.
Okay, so it's Shabbat, May 7th, 2016. And here we are at the Marquise Bible Study. Let's open with some prayer. Lord, thank you for your mercies, your grace that covers us. Thank you for giving us the Bible and help us understand it more and apply it more deeply in our life. We pray that you would inspire our conversation today, our thoughts, and fill us with your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So some of our regulars are missing today. But let's go ahead and read. We've been doing the triennial cycle, of course, and we're in the middle of the Jacob stories. We've looked at Rachel and Leah, and they're kind of bickering back and forth. And now we're in chapter 31, and there's more bickering in a way. There's tension between Jacob and Laban, Laban, and we're going to see that all the way through. I don't mind just reading, even though officially our parasha starts at chapter 3, we might as well just backtrack to chapter 1 just to set the stage, so to speak. So, Sally, if you could start, read, let's say 10 verses, then we'll keep going.
But then he heard what Laban's sons were saying. Yaakov has taken away everything that our father once had. It's from what used to belong to our father that he has gotten so rich. He also saw that Laban regarded him differently than before. Adonai said to Yaakov, "Return to the land of your ancestors, to your kinsmen. I will be with you." So Yaakov sent for Rachel and Leah and had them come to the field where his flock was. He said to them, "I see by the way your father looks that he feels differently towards me than before. But the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, and that your father has belittled me and has changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to do me any damage. If he said, 'The speckled will be your wages,' then all the animals gave birth to speckled young. And if he said, 'The streaked will be your wages,' then all the animals gave birth to streaked young. This is how God has taken away your father's animals and given them to me. Once, when the animals were mating, I had a dream. I looked up, and there in front of me, the male goats, which mated with the females, were streaked, speckled, and mottled."
Okay. Continue on.
"Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, 'Yaakov,'" "'Yaakov,' and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Lift your eyes now and see, all the mountains which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and grey spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your kindred.' Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it.' Then Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's.
Your translation said had stolen?
Had stolen the household.
That's strange.
Idols. This is the New King James.
Yeah. The first part's right. Laban had gone down to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the tophim. That anyway.
That were her father's, and Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee.
He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." And Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you've tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre? And why did you permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly, which is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.' And now you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?"
Jacob answered Laban, "I was afraid, because I thought you would take your daughters away from me by force. But if you find anyone who has your gods, he shall not live. In the presence of our relatives, see for yourselves whether there is anything of yours here with me, and if so, take it." Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen the gods. So Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two maidservants, but he found nothing. After he came out of Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them inside the camel's saddle and was sitting on them. Laban searched through everything in the tent but found nothing. Rachel said to her father, "Don't be angry, my lord, that I cannot stand up in your presence. I'm having my period." So he searched but could not find the household gods. Jacob was angry and took Laban to task. "What is my crime?" he asked Laban. "What sin have I committed that you hunt me down? Now that you've searched through all my goods, what have you found that belongs to your household? Put it here in front of your relatives and mine, and let them judge between the two of us. I have been with you for 20 years now. Your sheep and goats have not been scattered, nor have I eaten rams from your flocks. I did not bring your animals home by wild beasts. I bore the loss myself, and you demanded payment from me for whatever was stolen by day or night. This is my situation. The heat consumed me in the daytime, and the cold at night, and sleep fled from my eyes."
Go ahead.
Okay, sure.
41, verse 41.
Just a sec, I'm going to read from the JPS. "Of the 20 years that I spent in your household, I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages time and again. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac been with me, you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God took notice of my plight and the toil of my hands, and he gave judgment last night." Then Laban spoke up and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. Yet what can I do now about my daughters or the children they have borne? Come then, let us make a pact, you and I, that there may be a witness between you and me." Thereupon Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. So they took stones and made a mound, and they partook of a meal there by the mound. Laban named it Yigal Shahaduta, but Jacob named it Galaed. And Laban declared, this mound is a witness between you and me this day. That is why it was named Galaed. And it was called Mitzpah, because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are out of sight of each other. If you ill-treat my daughters or take other wives besides my daughters, though no one else be about, remember, God himself will be witness between you and me.
Okay, so I'll continue from 51. This is the pile of stones and this pillar I've set up between me and you, Laban said to Jacob. This pile of stones and the pillars are reminders that I will not pass beyond this pile to come to harm you, and that you will not pass beyond this pile and this pillar to come to harm me. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the gods of their father, judge between us. Jacob took an oath by the God whom his father Isaac feared. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and invited his relatives to eat the meal. They ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban kissed his grandchildren and his daughters goodbye and blessed them. Then Laban left and returned home. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he exclaimed, this is the camp of God. So he named that place Mahanaim. Jacob sent messengers on ahead to his brother Esau, the land of Seir, the region of Edom. He commanded them, this is what you must say. That begins the next parasha. So we just get the little section on Mahanaim. And actually, let's see. The Hebrew verse 3 ends with Mahanaim. In English, that's verse 2. So I shouldn't have kept going to sending messengers ahead, even though the link is the Malachim, but we'll talk about that. So there's our parasha story in all its strangeness. The other sections are fairly short. I think we can go ahead and read them quickly before we discuss everything in Genesis 31. So let's read Jeremiah 30, verses 10 to 18. Jeremiah 30, 10 to 18. Sally, do you want to start again?
So don't be afraid, Yaakov, my servant, says Adonai, or be alarmed, Israel, for I will return you from far away and your offspring from their country of exile. Yaakov will again be quiet, at rest, and no one will make him afraid. For I am with you to save you, says Adonai. I will finish off all the nations where I have scattered you. However, you I will not finish off, but will discipline you only as you deserve. I will not completely destroy you. For here is what Adonai says. Your wound is past healing, your injury most severe. No one thinks your wound can be bandaged. You have no medicines that can heal you. All your friends have forgotten you. They no longer seek you out. I have struck you down as an enemy would, punished as a cruel man would, because of your great wickedness, because of your many sins. Why cry that your wound and pain are past healing? I have done these things to you because of your great wickedness, because of your many sins. But all who devour you will be devoured. All your enemies will go into exile. Those who plunder you will be plundered. Those who pillage you will be pillaged. For I will restore your health. I will heal you of your wounds, says Adonai, because they called you an outcast, Zion, with no one who cares about her. Thus says Adonai, I will return Yaakov's captives to their tents. I will take pity on his dwellings. Cities will be rebuilt on their own tells, with palaces where they're supposed to be.
Okay. Thank you. Once again, Jerusalem, Zion. Now we're going to look quickly at Micah, that's also listed. Micah 6, 3 and following. Whenever it's 3 and following, I'm not sure how far to go down, but we'll at least go to the famous verse, Micah 6, 8. So maybe Florence, would you read for us Micah 6, 3 to 8?
O my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, devised, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him, and what happened when she came to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before an idol? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?
Okay. So, and it continues. I don't know, maybe we should also continue. Okay, let's go all the way to verse 15.
In Micah. 6:15.
Or, you know what? Finish a chapter. We'll just finish a chapter.
Starting from verse 9?
Yes.
Okay, starting from 6:9.
Do you want to do it, Jordash, with your JPS version?
Yeah.
Go for it.
6:29. Then will your man achieve wisdom. Hark, the Lord summons the city. Hear, O scepter, for who can direct her but you? Will I overlook in the wicked man's house the granaries of wickedness and the accursed short ephah? Shall he be acquitted despite wicked balances and a bag of fraudulent weights? Whose rich men are full of lawlessness, and whose inhabitants speak treachery with tongues of deceit in their mouths. I, in turn, have beaten you sore, have stunned you for your sins. You have been eating without getting your fill, and there is a gnawing at your vitals. You've been conceiving without bearing young, and what you bore I will deliver to the sword. You have been sowing, but have nothing to reap. You have trod olives, but have no oil for rubbing, and grapes, but have no wine to drink. Yet you have kept the laws of Omri and all the practices of the house of Ahab, and have followed what they devised. Therefore, I will make you an object of horror, and her inhabitants an object of hissing, and you shall bear the mockery of peoples.
Okay. So, let's just dive into it. What do you see as parallels, or let's start in the big picture, big scheme of things. What could be linking these passages together?
Treachery.
All right. Did I spell that right?
C-H.
What do you say?
C-H.
Ah. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't quite look right. Funny how that is.
I know
Yes.
Gotta love English. That's a nice big word, treachery. It kind of sounds ominous.
Yeah.
It's deceitful and ominous together. What else?
In the last two passages, the idea that one will punish people for their sins.
Okay, and we have, okay, so Jeremiah and Micah are talking about punishment for sins. Mm-hmm. And what specific sins?
Corrupt balances. That
yeah.
Nothing fair.
Corruption. I'll say deceit, because it mentioned both the balances and just lying.
That's right.
Rigging things. And in your JPS version, you read about Hamas. The rich people are filled with Hamas, which oftentimes is in verse 11 of Micah 6. Oftentimes we translate this word violence, but as I've mentioned before, it can be more than that. And can you read your JPS translation again, Jordash?
Hyphen after verse 11, whose rich men are full of lawlessness, and whose inhabitants speak treachery.
Okay. Full of lawlessness. I like that, because violence, I think, is too restricted a meaning for Hamas. It certainly can mean that, like physical violence, but it can also mean social violence. So lawlessness, basically not being afraid of the authorities and being able to abuse everyone under you. I think it carries all those meanings in it. And so I like that lawlessness idea. And we have a link of rich.
Mm-hmm.
So who is rich in our Genesis story? Who's rich?
Lavan.
Laban the Aramean.
All these flocks are mine, even these daughters are mine, everything is mine.
What else is he? He's obviously rich. What else is he? How would you define his character?
Deceitful.
Okay, deceitful.
And lying. He says all these flocks are mine.
Okay. Certainly twisting the truth. What?
A
brute?
Bully.
Yeah. Yes. Bully. What else when it comes to riches? What else is he like? You might have to think back. Tight. Okay. That's a nice way to put it. How about greedy? Greedy's a not so nice way to put it. If you think back to when we first met Lavan, what happened in his household?
Rachel arrived with wearing the jewels.
Ooh.
Yes. And do you remember when he wanted to give hospitality? It says, let's look back there. Help us out here. It's Genesis. Is it 24 is Rebecca. Genesis. Maybe it is. Actually, it is Rebecca. It's his sister. Okay. I'm in Genesis 24. Rebecca meets the servant of Isaac.
30, I think.
Okay.
Or 29 and 30. That was 24, 29.
So, and so before that, in verse 22, we know that the man took out a gold nose ring weighing a beka, which is 2 ounces, 5 to 6 grams of gold. So I'm sure we wouldn't have been told the weight unless it was significant.
Right.
I think this is a pretty heavy for a nose ring. And 2 gold bracelets weighing 10 shekels. Which I have a note, that's 11.5 grams. So they weighed about 4 ounces. And we're talking about gold here. And he gives them to her. And he says, you know, whose daughter are you? Tell me, is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? And she tells him, okay, so now skip down to verse 30.
Even 29.
Yeah, even 29. Okay, now Rebecca had a brother named Laban. Lavan, same guy we're talking about. Lavan rushed out to meet the man at the spring. When he saw the bracelets on his sister's wrists and the nose ring, and heard his sister Rebecca say, "This is what the man said to me," he went out to meet the man. So what inspires him to meet this man? The bracelet and the nose ring. Okay, he is interested in gold. And tacked on at the very end, and what Rebecca said, you know, all the nice story, how, you know, God provided and this and that. But you clearly see his priorities. It's not the other way around. It's not, oh, what an awesome miracle. God found you, you know. He traveled all this way internationally and ends up at just the right spring that you go out to meet him, and it just fulfills what his prayer had been. Isn't that wonderful? No, it's just the bracelets. There you go. So he's greedy for gain, you could say.
He almost reminds you of Jacob. That's one of the first stories with Jacob, is where he's swindling his brother. That's kind of how he gets introduced into
the community, right? So you could say he's a perfect match for Jacob. Yeah. So this is sometimes the first thing we see a biblical character do is a significant statement as to their character. So we already know Lavan is greedy, and all his hospitality is actually seems to be based on what he can get out of it or who you are. So it's not like Abraham, who runs out to meet strangers and doesn't expect anything in return. And in fact, Laban does get something in return from Jacob eventually. He gets, what does he get? He gets slave labor. That's what he gets. If you look at the text, let's go back to Genesis 31. Okay, as we read the first two verses that set the stage, there's tension, first of all, about riches. So again, we have this Laban counting his pennies and his workers too, because the way Laban's character is has influenced his workers as well. And maybe there are also other kinsmen working for him. He doesn't seem to have a problem putting his relatives to work. So they're saying all this wealth, and in Hebrew it's actually kavod, all this glory, wealth, honor, it's really Lavan's and not Yaakov's. And Jacob gets a little scared. And it's very interesting here how, to me, the switching between the human plane and the supernatural plane. Because as you look at the story, you see human tensions caused by character traits. Like Lavan is greedy, right, and he basically wants to twist every situation he sees to get the most out of it for himself. And Yaakov,
he's got power too.
And he's got the power. Yaakov doesn't have the power, but he seems to be quite smart in outwitting him. And he'd also like to twist the situation in his favor. And so, and he apparently, in verse 2, he notices that Laban is not acting the same towards him as he used to. But then we have verse 3, where God actually comes out and says, "Go back to your father's land and to your birthplace, and I will be with you." In the same way at Bet-El, he promised that I will be with you. So there's that theme that connects them back. And at that point, Jacob had promised that, you know, if you lead me and do all these things, you know, I'll come back here. So we kind of have a full circle at this point. But it's interesting that he doesn't get this divine command until the situation with Laban is maybe at its most tense, and he actually needs to get away and run away, which is similar to when he left, right? Why did he leave Canaan? Esau wanted to kill him. He's got some tension there. And then all of a sudden, Isaac says, you know what? You need to go get a wife. Why don't we ship you off to Padan Aram, and you can find a wife. So you can see the need, the push and the pull, you could say, on the human level. And then you have a little divine command come in and kind of sanction it. It's certainly interesting when I try to think how to apply this to our lives today.
Right.
You know, what that means and how that looks like. How did he hear from God? It just says God told him. Was it a divine-inspired thought? Like, I'm reading the situation and I'm seeing now would be a good time to leave. And all of a sudden you remember, oh yeah, you know, God did want me to come back at some point, so this is it.
And with the use of moledet,
yeah,
it reminds you of Genesis 12.
It sure does. It's an exact flip. God like called Abraham out of his birthland into the land he'll show him. And here, Yaakov, who is Abram's grandson, well, his birthland is Canaan.
Right.
So in this case, he's being called to his birthland.
And to the land of his fathers.
Into the land of his fathers, right, which
yeah.
has now been flipped. So the land of Abraham is now Canaan for Yaakov. He has been raised there. And I will be with you. That promise stays the same. I will be with you.
The picture of this kind of a creature is very strange and comforting, I guess. This person has so many character flaws.
Yaakov, yeah, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The grandson of someone who got basically the same kind of a call, and the wording is very similar, he calls us, and you think God is with this person despite all the skullduggery,
the sneaky dealings
that this person has been up to.
Yeah. And that's the, like, I agree with you, it's comforting because God sees our good and our bad at the same time. And he sees all those sneaky dealings, but he sees something else.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look in verse 5.
31:5.
Yeah, 31:5. Okay, wait, no. It's further on. First, he gives a speech to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll get there in a second. Notice also he's called Leah and Rachel out to the field where he is. So he doesn't even go home. So this is kind of secretive,
mm-hmm.
because it's not something that would normally happen. It's like not going back to your house to get your things. You know, it's like you come out here, we're going to make this plan, and we're going to take off before anyone notices.
He did not post this on Facebook.
Right. And he says, notice in verse 6, if you're reading in Hebrew, Ve'aten na yeda'aten. He's saying, you know. Right? He could have just said yeda'aten. That already says you know.
Mm-hmm.
You, plural girl, know. But he says, you know. And so in my mind, that's contrasting with other people don't, or specifically Lavan doesn't. He doesn't know, but you guys know. So Yaakov is trying to convince his wives to be on his side. So you guys know that, you know, I've worked for your father with all my strength. And of course, avadati, to serve or to work, in English can go two ways. You could also say slaved. Eved is a slave. Like, he is a working person. When you have wages, that's like a day's... You're a laborer. You're a serf, if I could use an anachronism from medieval Europe. You are working for wages. You're not a free person, a landowner, with your own workers. And so he has worked for her father. Also in verse 7 of chapter 31, your father has deceived me. He comes out and says that. Hetel. is to make fun of me by not telling or deceiving me somehow, to trick me. This is the same word. Where else do we get it? Anyone remember?
Oh, is this with Judah and Tamar? Is it there?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But another man and a woman.
Hetaltabi.
Samson and Delilah. That's right. You tricked me.
Okay, there it is.
She keeps accusing him of tricking her or deceiving. And in this case, the deception was changing his wages. Again, we have this reference to the wages. 10 times. Now, we haven't heard any of this, right? This is all backward looking.
Right.
We do know of what deception from Laban to Jacob?
Oh, the marriage.
The marriage. That's a huge deception.
Yeah.
And maybe that's connected to wages because he actually works for his wives,
right,
if you've noticed.
Mm.
And so then he goes into details explaining to his wives, you know, if whatever he set the wage to be, that's what would happen. Look in verse 9. And God saved. It says, God saved the flock, your father's flock, and gave it to me. Interesting choice of words there. Like the sheep were somehow in danger with Laban, and God saved them, and now they're with me. And then he tells a specific event. So he's already said how, you know, whatever he set the wages, the sheep just started giving those, whether it was speckled or whatever. But now he tells us of a dream from God. And so this, you know, back to our thoughts on the supernatural along with Jacob's own ways, you could say. So he sees, what does he see in his dream? He sees the male goats mounting the female goats. And they are striped, spotted, and mottled. And then an angel of the Lord says to him in the dream, you know, look. Look at all these male goats mounting the female goats. They're striped, spotted, and mottled. And then this is what I wanted to point out earlier. And what does he say? Because
I've seen everything Laban has been doing to you.
I've seen everything Laban's been doing to you. So even though Jacob is sneaky, it's still true that Laban's sneaky and has been unjust to him. And God doesn't say, well, you know, serves you right because you're a sneaky person. He actually says what Laban's been doing is wrong. And maybe because, you know, Jacob is part of the promise, but I think it's also Laban was in the position of power. And so the people in the position of power are the ones held accountable when you have a situation of injustice. And then he says, I'm the God of Bet-El, that you know, anointed the matzevah there, and you did an oath. You did a neder. Okay, so he says all of this to his wives. And it's interesting what their response is. What do they respond? He's just listed all his complaints against his father-in-law. And these are the father's daughters, right? So what do you expect to happen? Maybe a little defense, a little, well, you don't understand him, and no, he really loves you, you're his son-in-law. No, they add to his complaints. They said, do we have any inheritance in the household of our father? That's really interesting. And I don't know enough about inheritance rights in the ancient Near East, but I have a feeling here that they have been ripped off somehow, and they're aware of it.
Maybe because all the flocks have passed Jacob, because they get born and stripped, and so Laban is actually not so rich at this point.
You think that Laban is not so rich? I don't know. I think he's not the kind of person to let himself become poor. And the one hint I have is Laban goes out to shear his flock, but he's not going out to where Jacob is, or he would have seen him. He's going to another flock. So that tells me he has at least two giant flocks, and even Jacob's flock is divided into stuff he considers his own and stuff that is Laban's. So let's say he has a franchise. You know, everybody has little franchises for Laban. He's going out to another flock. He's got to be still wealthy then. Besides the fact that, you know, we know his general character is to try to get gain.
But what's this about that he sold them?
Okay, so this is what interests me. First they say, we have no more inheritance with our father's house. Aren't we like foreigners? Aren't we considered like foreigners to him? Mm-hmm. Because he sold us. So,
finally, Leah gets to say that she feels hurt, at least Rachel does too, but I mean, she was totally sold.
Yeah.
Like an object.
Like a slave, yeah. Slave girl. Yeah. Is like, you work for me and I'll give you her. Mm-hmm. And maybe more. Maybe there was a deal with the inheritance that that wasn't completed or wasn't transacted because of how they got married. Like maybe if Laban could consider it a slave marriage, he didn't have to give them anything.
Yeah.
Like the text doesn't actually tell us except from this response. We know there was something underhanded in their weddings that denied them what they should have had if they had been married properly. And I do remember, I took a course way back when at Hebrew University, this phrase, le'echol kesef, to eat up the money, that is some type of known phrase, I guess in legal literature. I think it has to do, I mean, we have it also in the Bible later for widows, but there is some type of right to money or whatever inheritance that he has wronged them. And I'm not an expert in it, so I don't know, I don't even remember the details of what that means, but that is a recognized phrase that you find in literature outside the Bible as well.
So maybe the daughters get some wealth from the father when they're married.
Yeah, I mean, normally in this type of culture you would have a dowry, so it could be that. It could also be, let's see, the net translated, he not only sold us, but completely wasted the money paid for us. And the question is, what money was paid for them? It was labor. So I don't know. There was more to it. But there is emphasis there. Vayochal gam achol et kaspenu. He's also really eaten up all our money. And the net note says the word money is used figuratively here. It means the price paid for Leah and Rachel. A literal translation, our money, makes it sound as if Laban wasted money that belonged to Rachel and Leah, rather the money paid for them. But we never heard of any money paid for them. But I guess they're saying just the worth of money in those years of service. And it's all gone to nothing. And it says all the wealth that God has saved from our father is ours and for our children. Okay, so they're saying, yeah, we totally agree with you because he did us wrong too. He's taken what is rightfully ours, and now God has delivered it back. He'd see, this is to save it. God saved it.
I can't help but be really sad for Levon. Not because he deserves pity or anything, just what tragedy he's brought about in his own life.
Yeah.
Destroyed his own relationship with his kids, potential good relationship with his son-in-law. And what is he having? If you die with that stuff, it doesn't make your life better if you have more stuff. It just feels crazy.
Yeah. Why should it matter? But that's how biblical stories can teach subtle lessons. You know, don't be greedy. What good does it do you in the end?
Being in a position of power, you want to be powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't understand is why they keep sending like the ones at the Yitzhak, they sent him back to this guy to be the wife too. Why do they keep sending their kid back to be the wife?
That's a good question, you know? Is it to be different than the peoples of the land? You know how Isaac and Rebekah, they said, we can't stand these Hittite women, or clearly the Canaanite women. And even Esau, in the end, he perceives his parents don't like the local women, so he tries to go find Ishmael, who is somehow related to Abraham, like closer to the family, and takes the Ishmaelite wife. Yeah, it's a good question. Why go back to your family? What's so great about them? And I think there's nothing great about them. It's just the distinction of not choosing a local wife. And that somehow was very important to Abraham. Maybe because he wanted to be a pure implant, so to speak, where you couldn't ever say, like, well, he just married into us, and so he's accountable to us. Like, we still can pull strings on what he does or doesn't do. So Abraham kind of viewed it as if and when he becomes accepted in the land, it will be on his own terms as a complete transplant, not as I just kind of got in under you guys. He didn't like the dhimmi, if I can borrow a Islamic term. Okay, so what happens in verse 19 to complicate this story? I've already mentioned Laban goes out. It says, now Laban went out to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the teraphim that were her father's. This came up in our Bible study last week already, and I saw it in context of what's just happened. I saw it as an attempt to get what was rightfully hers. You could read it both ways. Some people read it, why does she steal these teraphim? They're household gods. They're usually big statue-like things, decorated. What are gods, if you look at the prophets, what is on a god? An idol. I think, was it Jeremiah goes into detailed descriptions. You know, first you take the wood and you coat it in silver or gold. So these things are valuable, right? They're worth a lot of money. So you could say she's stealing them for protection on the way, maybe. But you could also say, hey, my dad cheated me out of giving me any inheritance. I'm just going to go take it because this is rightfully mine. And if you look at the sentence right before, she says, look, all this wealth that God saved from my father is really ours. It was justifiably ours in the first place.
Everybody's claiming that in this story.
Yeah, it's ours. So really, why not add to it the teraphim? You know, because he should have given it to me anyway. He didn't, therefore I'm just going to take it. So she steals it. And then the following verse, in verse 20, Jacob also steals what?
The heart.
The heart. And it's very strange. Like, what would that mean? And then it explains it in the sense that he didn't tell him that he was running away. But we have it twice in this section that Jacob steals the heart.
Sorry, is that verse 20?
That is verse 20.
So it says something more literal than my translation.
Vayigno Yaakov et Lev Lavan.
What does it say in your translation in verse 20?
Simply that he tricked
Laban. I got
outwitted. Outwitted, yeah. Mm-hmm. So people are trying to explain this idiom. Mm-hmm. But the literal thing, and it only comes as this exact idiom these two times. Once in Jacob's mouth, and I guess further on in Laban's mouth. So he stole Laban's heart. And I think it's because the author is trying to use this word steal.
And Lev Lavan.
Lev Lavan.
Yeah,
the heart of Laban. And again, heart is everything. It's where you make your plans, your thoughts, your desires.
I wonder whether Rachel saw those idols as the source of Laban's wealth and also the source of his trickery. Did she have some revelation on that and took them and thought, right, your household will
maybe
fall if I take these?
So that's even more vindictive. Not just like, I want my rights from you, but I actually want you to fall.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's interesting. I did a little word search on stealing in the Bible, and it only actually comes 49 times, or in 49 verses. It might be several times in the same verse, but roughly 50 times in the Bible. And so it's not the most common word you could find. And out of those 50 times, many of them happen in this cluster of stories, and then again in the Joseph stories. So it's kind of interesting that stealing is associated with Rachel and Jacob, even though they're in different expressions or whatever, but they're still using those words. Mm-hmm. Even if you think back when Jacob was justifying himself to Laban, he said, if there was something stolen by day or stolen by night. Mm-hmm. So this repetition of stealing, I think I counted about 10 times in Genesis 31. So 10 times out of 50. That's pretty significant. And then also, again, in the Joseph story, it comes a couple times. Of course, we have the commands. No, you shouldn't steal. And the very interesting command in Exodus 21:16. Whoever kidnaps, whoever steals a person, whoever kidnaps someone and sells him or is caught still holding him must surely be put to death. Because one way slavery begins, this happened in Africa too, a rival tribe steals someone and sells them to someone else, and then they become a slave. And here the punishment for that is death. That's pretty high. And so I get the feeling that God, even though some of his laws have allowed for slavery, he really doesn't like it. And he says, don't steal. So when he says, don't steal, he's referring to things as well as people. Okay, so there's many laws against not stealing. And then also, as I mentioned in the Joseph account, Joseph explains his own experience as, I was surely stolen from the land of the Hebrews. And the other link, the person who steals a person and sells him. That's interesting because Rachel and Leah have said, we were sold. So in a sense, they feel like property unjustly. It's as if they were stolen from their normal position because they're daughters of a landowner. They are actually aristocracy. Again, I'm using anachronisms, but things we can relate to. And it's like they were stolen and sold as if they're slave girls. So they're feeling completely, what's the word I'm looking for? Abused?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unjustly put in the wrong place? So we can put stealing in all its connotations as a link. Now let's go back to Genesis 31. There was something else I'm looking to say. Wait. Okay, so he runs away. He goes toward Har Gilad, which is, it's east, it's on the east side. It's the part that's like seconded. It's part of Canaan, but on the east side of the river. Eventually, Menashe gets it. And they always kind of do their own thing, if you follow history. You'll see that people, there are even times in the northern kingdom where the Gilad is ruled by a different king simultaneously with someone in Samaria. So, but it is a kind of a, it's, if he's trying to leave Aram, it's past the border of Aram, let's say. It's officially Canaan. Okay, and he gets chased, and that's where they meet in the Gilad. And of course, this is important because what is a place name at the end? Gal-ed. And you can hear Gilad, Gal-ed. There's a name play there. So Gal is a wave or a pile of something. Ed is a witness. And incidentally, the only two words in Aramaic in the Torah are here. Yigal Sahaduta. And they're listed in Aramaic here because Lavan, as we know, is repeatedly referred to as an Arami. He's Aramean. Arami, Arami, Arami. And it's also interesting, we've just done Pesach, where we recite Arami Oved Avi. Remember the passage? My father was a wandering Aramean, referring to Abraham. So Abraham's family is Arami, as we know Laban's from his family. But a lot of these, this whole story is seen through the eyes of future relationships between the Arameans and the Israelites. So that's also a very interesting dimension to look at. Like somehow there's family, but there's repeated tension, and as we noted, everybody's claiming the same thing. They're saying, this is really mine, because we read Laban's words. The first thing he does is he says, all these things you have are really mine, right? So there's a contest over possessions between Aram and Israel, or Jacob.
And God tells him to not say anything, right? But he still says.
He still speaks, and that's a curious phrase, because God tells him in a dream, don't speak to him from good or evil. Anything from good to evil. And so the idea is that maybe this was more than just, it's not just literally don't speak to him, but don't make a pronouncement. Like you can't curse him, you can't even bless him. Because basically, I don't know, God doesn't want Laban to have any kind of influence, one way or another. But another little link is this, in verse 26, look at Laban talking to Jacob. You know, why did you steal my heart and you chased my daughters like captives of the sword? So it's really interesting because the daughter said he has treated us like foreigners, which you could see in the same realm as, you know, captives. Like, we haven't been treated like citizens. And now Laban's saying, you have chased them away as if they were just captives, slaves. And ironically, he's the one that put them in that slave category by treating Yaakov as a hired worker, as basically a slave, and making his daughters, you know, they're married to him, and so they're in that category now. So there's a little irony going on there. And he claims he would have sent him away happily with songs and dancing and, yeah, we wonder. And you didn't even let me kiss my sons and my daughters. So he says, I could have done you big harm, but, you know, the Lord came and kept me from doing that. And then he says, okay, so fine. You really wanted to go back home. I'm in verse 30. That's fine, I understand it. You really long to go see your clan, basically. But why did you steal my gods? So again, so here's this accusation of stealing. And that really makes Yaakov mad. But he also adds to it, before he answers the accusation, which of course we know from the text that he didn't steal and he doesn't know about the theft. But he starts out saying, I was afraid because I thought lest you would steal your daughters from me. He uses a different word for steal that I think in your translations they read forced. What does it say in verse 31? Okay, tigzol, you could say rob. I thought you would rob your daughters from me. So even he was afraid not only of the possessions he had earned, but even his wife's. Like nothing he owned was he secure in. He thought Lavan would somehow take it all back. Which of course he did claim they're all his. But then he says, if you find, or Yeah, if you find your gods, you know, he basically says that person would die. Where did I read that?
32.
Yeah, there you go. Whoever's taking your gods will be put to death. It's pretty strong. It says, with where you find your gods, he won't live. So with whoever you find those gods, that person won't live. That's another way of saying he'll die. Thankfully, he didn't find him because his favorite wife was the one who stole it. And again, the word steal. And we have all the funny story. And notice when when Lavan looks through the tent, he's like looking in every place. Uses the word, lemashesh, vaymashesh. That's to feel. Like, this is the same word when you're blind, you feel around, you grope. Like every little thing he's gone through. And so, again, we're reminded of his greed and maybe a little bit suspicion here. Okay, I also wanted to see his Oni. Where did we read Oni? Because now he gives a speech to Lavan to vindicate himself and all the hardship he's been through. And he says, you know, God has proved between me and you. You know, I'm right, because 20 years I've been with you. Rechelecha, you know, we know the name Rachel. He says, your ewes and your goats never miscarried. And he goes through, I never ate them. I never, you know, came with a goat that had been torn up by a wild beast. I always repay things. And he goes through that whole list. And of course, there's some play on words with Rachel being a ewe. Of course, she hasn't miscarried either because she hasn't had any kids yet. Or has she? She's had one. She hasn't had Binyamin. And he says, and he accuses them of changing the wages 10 times. And he says in verse 42, if the God of my father had not been with me, you would have sent me home empty, completely empty. And so God has seen, what has God seen in verse 42?
His distress and his hard work.
His distress and hard work, his affliction. And that goes back to what we were talking about, how even though Jacob himself is crafty, he's still been being deceived and being afflicted by other people. And God doesn't like that. That goes against his standards. And Oni, we often think of its affliction. What does it remind us of?
Egypt.
Yeah, again, you have a case of forced work, forced slavery. And I was just thinking of the parallel, because just if you follow the word steal, you get this parallel between Jacob in Aram and Yosef in Mitzrayim. It's kind of like a theme word. And in both places, you're talking about one of the Israelites, a patriarch of Israelite, that's in a foreign land and subjugated against justice. Right? It was unjustly treated, maybe because he's a foreigner and he's in a naturally vulnerable situation. And God sees their affliction and brings them back to the land of Canaan. So it's an interesting parallel between Aram on the one hand and Egypt on the other. So you have the Syrian slavery and you have the Egyptian slavery. Defined slightly differently, but nonetheless similar.
And even the phrase, and last night he passed judgment in my favor, that reminded me of this.
Yes, he passed judgment. Leochiach is to, like if you go to court and you have a dispute, Leochiach is to yeah, I guess you could say pass judgment, or figure out who's right and who's wrong, and make a decision. It's also to reprove. We get it a lot in the prophets as well. And I think that that is also a link. We read somewhere there is a tzidkati mentioned. If you think back to this passage in Jeremiah, when God says, you know, I let you be punished because of all your sins, but it was for the goal of mishpat, like justice. And elsewhere, they will see the justices of the Lord. He uses two words that come up, mishpat and tzedakah, or tzidkati. And that's also a link in our text. There's somewhere that I didn't write it down well enough. But Jacob mentions his tzidkah. Well, we can find it later. And adding on to the irony we've been mentioning, if you jump down to 50, verse 50, after they made this agreement, first of all, the fact that they're making this agreement shows they're not friends. If they're friends and family, you really don't need to make a treaty. These are basically friendly enemies. Or there would be enemies that somehow have been prevented from being full-on enemies. And Laban says, if you oppress or afflict my daughters, and if you take other wives on them. So that's really interesting, because you could say Lavan's the one that oppressed them and put them in a position, you know, compromise their position. And so he acts here like his daughter's welfare is important to him. Very ironic. Okay, so then the very end. This site where they make this agreement is going to be the border. And they can cross back and forth, but not to do wrong. So crossing to do wrong is basically war. You can't make war against me, I won't make war against you. Like, this is our border. And then he says, may God, the God of Abraham and Nahor, judge between us. And so they make an oath. So again, Yishpetu is back to this Mishpat. You know, God sees the true justice. Yeah, we're over time. So as we leave, you can think about those things. The claim of us, maybe we're deceitful and do things wrong, but on the other hand, God also seeks to repay our injustices, which is a very gracious thing that I found comforting. If you go back and read this section now, you'll notice some of these themes of justice. Even though God is chastising Yaakov, it's to bring about true justice. And so there are a lot of deep issues we can ponder. And we'll close there, and we can make our way downstairs to the worship service, which is starting now.
Thank you.
Yes.